The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm here with Guy Jafredi to talk about the startup world with a special focus on venture capital. This is episode 70, recorded on Thursday, November 6th. It's 8 in the morning for you, a bit later for me. I'm currently in Dubai and Abu Dhabi meeting with investors. I can tell you more about the trip later. Right now, there's a sandstorm and navigating the traffic has been an adventure. I'm glad I made it back to the hotel in time for the podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by our partner, Upscaler.ch. So what are we covering today?
In today's news section, we're talking about Mass Challenge, the recent McKinsey report on deep tech and Europe's trillion-dollar opportunity, and the insolvency of Ensoy. For our main topic, we're joined by Peter Staley for the fourth and final part of our Upscaler series. Then we'll answer a listener question on how a great competition slide should look. And finally, we'll review the most relevant transactions announced since our last episode.
Let's dive into the news. This week brought a real highlight for the Swiss startup scene. At the 10th anniversary of Mass Challenge Switzerland in Lausanne, the winners of this year's cohort were announced. The main prize, the Diamond Award worth more than 140,000 Swiss francs, went to the Zurich-based medtech startup Minerva. The spin-off is developing a wearable neuroprosthetic that restores foot sensation for people with nerve damage, for example, caused by diabetes, a powerful example of applied deep tech innovation from Switzerland. Other awards went to startups such as Apharos from ETH Zurich, which is using innovative metal foams to revolutionize cooling in high-performance electronics, and Cocomodo, which applies cell culture technology to produce climate-resilient cocoa. Guy, what does this level of success at Mass Challenge mean for the Swiss ecosystem in terms of international visibility and deep tech support?
First of all, congratulations to all winners, and of course, especially to the team we know well for winning the top prize. Mass Challenge is an extremely important pillar of the Swiss innovation ecosystem. I regularly support startups in the program as an expert in fundraising workshops. What makes Mass Challenge so valuable is that it doesn't just provide early-stage startups with capital, it gives them visibility and access to international networks. For deep tech companies in particular, that's absolutely crucial. They need partners, pilot customers, and validation far beyond Switzerland. When programs like Mass Challenge build those bridges, the entire ecosystem benefits.
Let's move to the second news item. McKinsey recently released a new study that has made quite a splash across the European VC ecosystem. It's titled Deep Tech, Europe's Trillion-Dollar Opportunity. According to the report, Europe could unlock up to $1 trillion in economic value by 2030 if it manages to systematically accelerate deep tech innovation, meaning startups in areas like AI, quantum technology, robotics, new materials, semiconductors, and sustainable energy. McKinsey calls this a true momentum moment. More than 6,000 deep tech startups are active today, more than twice as many as 5 years ago. And while classic software startups often rely on rapid scaling, McKinsey points out that deep tech companies tend to show higher patent density, stronger margins, and longer life cycles. Interestingly, they also reach unicorn status faster than many expect, on average 2 years earlier than pure software startups. At the same time, McKinsey warns that Europe is still leaving far too much potential on the table. Only 15% of global deep tech investments flow into Europe, and most of that capital clusters in a few hotspots like Munich, Paris, Zurich, and Stockholm. The biggest hurdles are later stage financing, limited industrialization capabilities, and a fragmented support landscape. Europe has world-class research and leading universities, but the gap remains between lab-level innovation and industrial application. McKinsey proposes building a deep tech engine, a network of capital, top-tier talent, and industry partnerships that enables scaling, with venture capital playing a central role not just as a financial partner, but as a catalyst for industrial implementation. It's a massive promise, $1 trillion if Europe truly commits to deep tech. Guy, do you see this as realistic or just a catchy McKinsey headline?
It's a great question. First, let's be clear. McKinsey is referring to the European definition of a trillion, meaning 1,000 billion. And I would say the number is realistic, but it won't happen by accident. Europe can't just sit back and expect to ride the next tech wave. The potential is real, but deep tech doesn't scale overnight. These technologies require enormous amounts of capital up front, and the scaling and profits come much later, often over decades, not years. So the trillion-dollar vision is a long-term project, not a five-year plan. We're talking about breakthrough technologies like next-generation microchips, new materials, energy systems, including fusion, mobility, healthcare, and agriculture. Redesigning and industrializing these sectors takes time and deep financial pipelines, which Europe currently lacks. Many European funds are simply too small to lead Series B or C rounds, especially when hardware or infrastructure is involved. And once companies grow large enough, they often struggle to secure rescue financing, as we recently saw with Northvolt, which had massive potential for Europe's energy transition, yet still went bankrupt. McKinsey is right to emphasize partnerships. When deep tech startups work closely with industrial players like Bosch, ABB, Roche, or Siemens, true scaling becomes possible. That's also the strength of the Swiss ecosystem. Excellent research, strong industrial anchors, and increasingly funds that can bridge the early growth phase, like what we do at Koyo.
So in essence, Europe has the talent and the technology. It just needs the capital and the patience to build deep tech at scale.
Exactly. Capital and a bit of courage. If Europe finds that long-term mindset, deep tech can absolutely become the next major growth wave after the software era.
Let's move on to a sad piece of news from the Swiss food startup scene. The Thurgau-based tofu producer Ensoy will shut down on November 30th, 2025. After 4.5 years, one of Switzerland's most ambitious plant-based food projects is coming to an end. Ensoy launched in 2021 with the vision of producing premium organic tofu made entirely from Swiss soybeans, sustainable, regional, and independent from imports. The company built a fully local value chain and worked closely with farmers in the region. Despite a loyal customer base and growing awareness for plant-based products, the economic foundation remained too weak, as the team explained in their customer announcement. Things initially looked promising. In spring 2024, Ensoy raised around 5 million francs in a seed round, including participation from Fälschli AG, a well-known Swiss chocolate manufacturer. The funds were meant to scale production and distribution and expand partnerships. But the capital wasn't enough to absorb high fixed costs and the intense competitive pressure in the food tech segment. With the closure at the end of November, all employees lose their jobs, and Switzerland loses one of its few truly local tofu producers. Guy, what does this case tell us about financing and scaling sustainable food tech startups in Switzerland?
Ensoy is another clear illustration of the structural challenges in this segment. You can do almost everything right, product quality, sustainability, regional sourcing, and still fail because there simply isn't enough capital. A food startup with its own production facilities faces completely different scaling dynamics than a software company. And if you're using premium, fully Swiss ingredients, costs rise sharply. The 5 million francs raised in the seed round may sound substantial, but in production-heavy businesses, the money burns fast. You need to finance staff, raw materials, logistics, distribution, and the entire production setup all at once. Ensoy shows that while Switzerland has strong innovation, the required capital base for industrial-scale food tech is still missing. Fundraising is especially difficult right now for food tech and material science startups. I just heard a pitch yesterday where a founder put it very clearly. Last year, 18 billion euros were invested into food tech across Europe. This year, the number is down to 4 billion. That drop speaks volumes about the environment these companies are battling in.
If you want to scale your startup quickly and effectively, not just grow, the Upscaler program is exactly what you need. It gives you access to a broad network of founders, entrepreneurs, and the right investors. More than 50 startups have already benefited from over 500 workshops, scaling their businesses nationally and internationally. If you want to take advantage of this personalized and hands-on support, you'll find all the information at www.upscaler.ch.
let's move to the main topic. Today, we're wrapping up our four-part mini-series on the Upscaler program with Peter Staley, Head of Entrepreneurship at the Swiss Entrepreneurs Foundation. In episode 54, we introduced the program and explored how it supports Swiss startups transitioning from idea to international scaling. Episode 58 focused on the role of experts, seasoned entrepreneurs who work closely with scale-ups over 24 months. In episode 67, we looked at real success stories from the program. And now, in this final episode, we're talking about what often stands in the way, the growth blockers. Whether it's structures, processes, or culture, almost every scale-up eventually reaches a point where growth slows down. With Peter, we want to explore what typically holds Swiss scale-ups back, how to spot these issues early, and what founders can do to regain momentum. Peter, great to have you back in the studio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's jump right into the diagnosis. Peter, you've been supporting scale-ups in the Upscaler program for years. In your experience, where do the biggest growth blockers arise? Financial, structural, or even cultural?
In my view, two factors matter most. The first one is financial. Switzerland still faces two major challenges here. The first has been known for a long time. Larger ticket sizes are difficult to secure. We simply don't have enough venture capital available for rounds above roughly 1.5 million. Efforts are underway to solve this by building larger funds and tapping into pension capital, but the issue persists. The second financial barrier is more recent. Many VCs are struggling to raise new LP commitments, which means they can't expand their funds. That creates a chain reaction that ultimately slows down startups. The second area is structural. Switzerland is a small home market, which makes it harder to scale into large international markets. Our ecosystem is strong when it comes to early stages and quick exits. But for growth and internationalization, the level of support isn't yet where it needs to be. Scaling requires highly experienced people and deeper involvement from industry, and that's still work in progress.
When a startup grows from 10 to 50 employees and suddenly seems stuck, how often is the real issue the product or the market? And how often is it the founder team itself, meaning leadership, communication, or lack of clarity in roles?
It's important to recognize that once a company enters the scaling phase, the famous product market fit is no longer the main bottleneck. At that stage, structures, leadership layers, and processes become critical. When growth accelerates, you need standardized systems. Otherwise, you end up with chaos instead of productivity and efficiency. The second major factor is the evolving role of the founders. Many founders have a fixed idea of what their role should be, but in a scaling company, you need to reassess your role constantly. When you take a job in an established SME, you apply for a clear position and maybe get promoted once or twice. In a startup, the journey is far larger. From founding and R&D to product development, go-to-market, and the full build-out of a company. It's nearly impossible for a single person to cover all those phases with equal strength, and recognizing that is essential.
This is a fascinating topic. Founders suddenly face an enormous amount of complexity in a very short time, and their own development needs to keep pace. So in the Upscaler program, what do you generally recommend in terms of direct reports? Should a founder have 5, 10, or even 50 or 100, like Jensen Huang at NVIDIA or Oliver Samwer at Rocket Internet? Both were extremely successful with very flat structures, but that only worked because they had the capacity and presence to be involved in everything. What's the right recommendation for most founders?
You have to be careful with absolute numbers because entrepreneurship is incredibly diverse. A production company has very different requirements from a software or services business. But in a fast-growing company, a reasonable number of direct reports is around 5. Clear responsibilities and clear decision-making authority are essential because speed is everything. And a CEO should always carve out about 30% of their time for strategic topics. If that doesn't happen, the company quickly falls behind on fundamental long-term questions. Many teams say they have no time for strategy because they are constantly fighting operational fires, but keeping that strategic space free is exactly what prevents stagnation.
Let's go a bit deeper into structure and processes. Many startups underestimate how critical structures become as they grow. When does it actually become dangerous to stay a startup for too long? And which core processes should be professionalized first? Is it even possible to generalize this?
From my experience, before a company moves into major growth, meaning internationalization, a certain level of structure and process standardization absolutely has to be in place. In our program, we separate processes into core, support, and management processes, and we start with the core. A core process is everything the customer pays for and everything that creates value. In an industrial business, that means supply chain, production, delivery, quality assurance, and after sales. In commerce, it could be procurement, storage, logistics, sales, and distribution. These core processes need to be standardized, documented, automated, or at least partially automated. That's the foundation. And we work closely with startups to prepare them early and build those processes before they scale.
And of course, the financial cockpit is a huge topic as well. Clear KPIs, board reporting, and so on. Especially in phases where growth consumes capital quickly. How critical is this? And when should these KPIs become a binding part of the reporting rhythm?
It's absolutely central. Most startups begin by treating finance as an afterthought, something done on weekends or outsourced to an accountant. Eventually, someone internally with a bit of talent takes it over. Only rarely can a young company afford a CFO, though that would be ideal. I always compare it to sitting in the cockpit of a plane crossing the Atlantic. The one instrument you absolutely need is the fuel gauge, which is your liquidity. If the tank runs dry, you end up in the water. Once investors are on board, especially VCs, it's time to build a proper cockpit with the most essential KPIs. It helps founders understand their own situation, anticipate the next fundraising round, and report clearly to their board and investors. In my view, it's one of the most important investments a growing company can make.
Let's move on to leadership and organization. In many companies, the founder themselves becomes the bottleneck. A classic growth blocker is that founders keep making all the decisions themselves. How do you recognize that a founder is holding back their own company, and how do you address that in coaching?
It's a crucial transition. In the early phase, founders do everything themselves. They're close to the product, the customer, and the development. But they must eventually shift into the role of an employer, with emphasis on employer, meaning they give work rather than doing it themselves. They need to delegate so they can focus on what a growing company requires: leadership, organization, administration. The key question becomes, is the founder still in the right role, and does it energize them? We evaluate this with a simple approach. First, we determine what puts the founder into a flow state. Do they reach that state when building product or when leading people? Then we analyze how much time they actually spend in that flow during a typical week. This forms the basis for an honest discussion. Is the founder still the right person in the right role? Are they delegating enough? Do employees have the necessary competence and responsibility to make the organization work? Those conversations require openness and trust, but the priority is always the company's success, not the ego of the individual. And to be clear, there are founders with egos that simply can't make this transition.
Sadly, yes. And that's when burnout or resentment starts to appear. In many startups, the product scales faster than the organization. You may reach product market fit and see demand explode, but the team constantly lags behind. How can leadership and team structure scale in a way that prevents that constant game of catching up?
This is fundamentally a responsibility of strategic leadership, the board. And in many scale-ups, the board is still a mix of founders and investors, perhaps with one or two independent members. So we work with scenario planning. You define target organizational structures for scenario A, B, and C, high growth, moderate growth, or no growth. For each scenario, you map out how the organizational structure should look and how many people you need. Then you set milestones, for example, every 3 months, and evaluate which scenario you're tracking toward. Once that's clear, you must execute quickly and adjust the structure accordingly. Without this discipline, companies constantly run 12 months behind and are permanently understaffed, which is neither effective nor sustainable.
Let's touch on external factors and your broader learnings. You often talk about door openers, partners, customers, or VCs who enable growth. How important are external networks to removing growth blockers? And when do they start creating additional pressure instead?
For the scaling phase, external networks are extremely important. The biggest unnecessary pressure they can create is through excessive reporting or meetings that waste time. That's often a real burden for founders. But the upside is enormous. Networks provide access to markets, investors, and suppliers. When someone you trust makes an introduction, everything becomes easier. You're not a nobody knocking on a door. Someone with credibility vouches for you, and that creates opportunity. External networks also carry experience. Many people in these networks have solved similar problems before. Tapping into that helps avoid mistakes, saves time, and preserves capital. Startups should leverage this as much as possible.
One last question for today. Looking at the Upscaler alumni, what distinguished those who managed to overcome their growth blockers most effectively?
For me, the answer is clear. Fast decision-making is one of the most important success factors, and that depends heavily on team structure. Many founding teams have three or four founders. The clarity of responsibilities and decision-making authority becomes crucial. If decisions are debated endlessly, progress dies. Duos often handle this more easily than larger teams. The second major factor is spending time in the field. The more a team talks to customers and actively collects feedback, the better they navigate the jungle. You cannot learn this from behind a laptop. You need direct contact, or at least a strong sales force with proper reporting. These ingredients, attention, agility, and customer proximity, are essential, especially today, where external conditions change much faster than 20 years ago.
So speed, a strong feedback culture, and customer proximity, the three core elements. Peter, thank you for sharing all of this. Over the past months, you've taken us from the early growth steps to the role of experts and now to the growth blockers. It's clear how much experience and pragmatism sits behind the Upscaler program and how deeply it supports Swiss scale-ups in their next stage. We're truly grateful for your insights and examples, and we wish you and the entire Upscaler team continued success. We're already looking forward to the next success stories we'll be able to feature on Burn Rate, whether as strong funding rounds or great exits.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Let's move to our listener question. Today's question comes from Sibylle in St. Gallen. She writes, I recently pitched my startup and the investor laughed at me because my competition slide wasn't convincing. So what does a good competition slide look like? Sibylle, that's a great question. I think about these slides constantly. We all know the classic chart where the axes are labeled just right, so you always end up in the top right corner, alone, of course. The competition slide is one of the trickiest and most underestimated parts of any pitch deck. For me, as an investor, it's crucial. If the slide is obviously manipulated, overly flattering, or simply not truthful, the case is dead. Many founders just list logos or show a table of green check marks, but that rarely convinces investors. A strong competition slide communicates something very different: that you understand your playing field, that you know who else is solving this problem, and that you are clearly positioned. In essence, it answers three questions. Who is solving the problem today, directly or indirectly? Indirect means substitutes as well. Other technologies solving the same pain. How do you position yourself against these solutions, and why is your approach defensible? Instead of claiming you have no competition, show what customers currently do and why your approach is better. Guy, you see dozens of pitch decks every month. What goes wrong most often?
The biggest mistake is downplaying or ignoring competitors. When someone says we don't have competition, investors immediately think the founders haven't understood the market. There is always a substitute. Even doing nothing counts. The second mistake is trying to show that you're better in every dimension. Always top right, always green check marks, and everyone else in red. That's a credibility trap. Sibylle, I recommend showing clearly where you are different. You're not superior in everything, and if you are in certain areas, you need very good explanations. Most importantly, explain why customers will buy your product and why they're willing to switch from an existing solution. In B2B software, for example, you could use axes like automation level versus integration effort. You might show that you are highly automated but easy to integrate. That clarifies your differentiation and proves you understand the market. And from there, you at least have a solid foundation for a productive discussion with the investor.
So what would you recommend in practice? How should a competition slide ideally be structured?
I would approach it as follows. First, define the playing field with a simple 2x2 matrix. That format works extremely well. Choose two axes that genuinely matter in your market. For example, price versus performance, or simplicity versus flexibility. Second, place your competitors on the matrix honestly, according to your best assessment. Investors know most of these players anyway, so it's far better to position them realistically than to push everyone artificially into the bottom left. If the slide is manipulated, it becomes obvious and investors will stop looking at the case. Third, position yourself clearly and visibly. Your logo can be a bit larger or more colorful so the differentiation stands out. Then briefly explain why your position is stronger. After that, highlight your moat, whether it's technology, IP, data, brand, community, or distribution access. Add a couple of short bullets on the side. Why can't you simply be copied? And optionally, if you already have traction, show that you're moving toward the attractive quadrant. That signals learning and progress.
So in summary, the competition slide isn't a piece of artwork. It's a reality check. It shows that you take your market seriously, that you understand your positioning, and that you're building a defensible moat. That's what investors want to see. Not perfection, but strategic clarity and transparency.
Exactly. Now let's move on to the deals of the week. Once again, a lot has happened, and it looks like we could be heading toward a spectacular end of the year if this pace continues. We've selected some of the most exciting transactions.
Let's start with the blockbuster deal of the week, which we'll also examine more deeply in our dedicated deal episode. The deal comes from the ETH ecosystem, DeepJudge. The legal tech company has raised a $41 million Series A, led by Felicis and Coetiu, at a valuation of around $300 million.
It's truly a mega round. Coetiu already led the seed round in June 2024, when DeepJudge raised about $8 million. Less than 18 months later, they've jumped into the top tier of legal AI startups. DeepJudge was founded by three former Google researchers, Paulina Kronerova, Kevin Roth, and Yannick Kilcher, all with AI doctorates from ETH Zurich. Their vision is to create a kind of Google search for internal law firm data. And that matters, because tools like ChatGPT or Google only help with public information. DeepJudge indexes internal firm knowledge, contracts, briefs, negotiation notes, and makes it searchable using AI. That saves time and prevents mistakes such as duplicated work or overlooking prior deals.
And because DeepJudge only indexes verified internal data, it virtually eliminates the risk of hallucinations. In a legal context, AI cannot invent facts, and their proprietary indexing ensures the system stays grounded in real information.
Firms like Gundersen Detmer, Holland and Knight, and Arendt Fox Schiff are already using the system. With the new capital, the team plans to expand in the US, grow engineering, and focus even more on large law firms.
Considering that competitors like Harvey recently reached an $8 billion valuation, it's clear the legal AI market is exploding. And seeing an ETH spin-off playing at this level globally is a strong signal for Swiss deep tech.
Absolutely. Staying in Zurich, our next transaction is Mimic Robotics, which closed a $16 million seed round, oversubscribed and led by Elia and Speed Invest.
A strong signal for the Swiss robotics scene. Mimic is an ETH spin-off working on humanoid robotic hands and a foundation model for robotic vision. Their goal is to give machines real human dexterity, not just pre-programmed movements.
Their approach is based on what they call physical AI. Human operators wear Mimic's data capture devices while performing real work in environments like factory floors. These motion data streams are then used to train the robots via imitation learning. The result? Robots learn fine motor skills and can adapt to changing situations.
That's what sets Mimic apart from classical industrial robotics. Instead of repeating fixed routines, the system reacts dynamically, corrects itself, and handles uncertainty. A real step toward autonomous learning robotics.
The company is led by Stefan Weyrich, and I find one of his quotes fascinating. "We make dexterity scalable, bringing what AI can do in the lab into industry." The technology is already being piloted with Fortune 500 manufacturers and global automotive brands. So this is not just research, it's deployment.
Alongside Elia and Speed Invest, 100 Ventures and the Sequoia Scout Fund also joined the round. Mimic has now raised more than $20 million, a strong foundation for an ETH spin-off founded only in 2024.
Definitely. Mimic Robotics embodies the shift from theoretical AI to industrial application, made in Switzerland.
And the third ETH highlight, Tethys Robotics from Zurich has raised 3.5 million euros in a pre-seed round led by Redstone, with participation from Alpine VC, Euragio Plus, ZKB, the ETH Foundation, Kick Fund, and Venture Kick.
The project originally emerged from the Weiss Center in Zurich, a powerhouse that produces many of the strongest deep tech spin-offs from ETH and the University of Zurich. They celebrated their 10-year anniversary on Monday, and Tethys presented there. What they showed was extremely impressive.
Tethys develops autonomous underwater drones for inspections in extreme environments, such as offshore wind farms or oil and gas platforms. Their system, Tethys One, is a hybrid autonomous unmanned vehicle that weighs just 35 kilos, can dive up to 300 meters, and is ready for deployment in under 10 minutes.
The key innovation is their combination of AI-driven navigation and sensor fusion. Sonar, 3D cameras, and metal detectors all work together in real time. This replaces dangerous and very costly dive missions with fully autonomous robotic inspections.
Jonas Wust, a robotics graduate and experienced diver, puts it perfectly. Offshore work is still dangerous, expensive, and analog. They're changing that.
The technology is already being tested with partners such as the Swiss Army and the Swiss Drone and Robotics Center. And if the team brings the system to production readiness, Tethys could transform the underwater inspection market, safer, more efficient, and more sustainable.
Another showcase of Swiss deep tech with global relevance, supported by Weiss Zurich and driven by a new generation of ETH founders.
Now from Zurich to Zug. Q Labs has emerged from stealth mode with a $10 million funding round led by Sequoia Capital and OSS Capital, with participation from Founders Fund and Dell Technologies Capital. Yes, you heard that right. Sequoia, one of the world's top funds, and Peter Thiel's Founders Fund are backing a Swiss startup coming out of stealth. Pretty crazy and a great sign for Switzerland.
Q Labs is solving one of the biggest problems in modern IT and AI infrastructure: faulty configuration. These mistakes cost companies billions every year and are often the cause of major system outages, from airlines to data centers.
Q Labs is building a configuration control plane based on the open source language, QU. It lets companies manage, validate, and version configurations centrally, finally making it possible to track which code changes which systems.
CEO Marcel van Lohuizen is well known. He spent more than 18 years at Google and helped build Borg, the cluster system that later inspired Kubernetes. Now he wants to establish the same standard for configurations that Kubernetes set for containers.
Q is already used at Microsoft, Alibaba, and Elastic. And with this funding, the team wants to scale the platform and set the standard for secure configuration management in the AI era.
Q Labs shows that global top-tier funds are looking at Switzerland and backing startups here with significant tickets. A very positive signal. And onto our final deal of the week, which connects art and artificial intelligence. The Zurich startup, Art Recognition, has raised $1 million from the Luxembourg-based fund AlphaStar. We know the company well. We were among the first backers when Karina and her team got started.
Absolutely. And it's fair to say that without our early financial support and know-how, the company might not be where it is today. AlphaStar focuses on innovative companies in the art market, making them a perfect strategic partner for Art Recognition. It's not just capital, it's a catalyst for scaling their technology internationally.
Founded in 2019, the company uses machine learning and computer vision to authenticate paintings and drawings, a data-driven alternative to the often subjective assessments of traditional art experts.
What's fascinating is that Art Recognition combines two neural networks to capture the unique stylistic characteristics of an artist. The system can even detect AI-generated forgeries.
More than 500 artworks from 20 countries have already been analyzed for auction houses, collectors, and galleries worldwide. and with Alpha Star from Luxembourg, the company now has a strong European partner that connects technology with art investments at a strategic level.
A great example of a female founder-led deep tech startup from Switzerland entering a traditional industry like the art market, even though that path is anything but easy.
Thank you, Guy, for today's episode. Let's see how the technical setup turned out. I'm heading out again here in Dubai before making my way to Abu Dhabi for meetings and events. I'll let you know how it goes. That's it for Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you'd like to support us, please subscribe to our newsletter and share it in your network. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Take care and goodbye.